This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. Happy Thanksgiving! Now, there's no denying it's been difficult for many of us this year. Although it's easiest to feel gratitude when things are going well, I tend to think it could be most important to take the time to focus on gratitude precisely at those times when things are at their most challenging. We'll have more on that idea in the show from Rabbi Irwin Kula. But first, 2 weeks ago in New York City, Interfaith Alliance honored this year's Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award recipients, the Right Reverend Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon and PBS News anchor Jim Lehrer. Receiving the President's Award was country singer Shelley Wright. We're very grateful for the contributions made by each of these people in service to the cause of religious liberty. And we thought Thanksgiving weekend would be an appropriate time to bring you some highlights from this year's awards ceremony. I think you're going to enjoy them. Singer Shelley Wright is the first major country artist to come out as gay or lesbian. The arc of her life, career, and struggle with authenticity has been profoundly challenging. But she found strength in a strong spiritual foundation and a commitment to truth. This has led Shelley to being the only person to have received awards from both the Country Music Association and the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, as well as a Lambda Literary Award for her autobiography, Like Me. Shelley's story is also told in the movie Wish Me Away, which has received awards at numerous film festivals. Here's President's Award recipient, Shelley Wright.
When I was 18 years old, I moved to Nashville, Tennessee, in search of the dream of country music. And it was a great experience. Nashville's a great town. And I went to work doing what it is that all artists do. We try our best to put down roots in a new town. Unfortunately, although I had quite a bit of success, my roots never got too deep. And what I mean by that is I didn't allow anyone to know me because I was hiding a very fundamental part of who I am. They knew me as a good American patriotic girl who loves the troops and loves her fans of country music and loves God. But they didn't know that I was also a lesbian, and I was scared to death to tell them. I was on top of the world, you would think. But I came crashing down because I had all of this success that I dreamed of. And the parts of me, the very real parts of me, were becoming more and more shrouded by the crimes I was committing against my spiritual self. And I ended up hitting my rock bottom and had my breakdown, which my good friend Mary said, "Honey, it wasn't a breakdown, it was a breakthrough." And as Welton shared with you, that I did find myself in a bad spot with a loaded 9mm in my mouth. And I want to make it clear, I didn't nearly take my life because I'm gay. I had known for a long time that God was cool with me and I was cool with God. I nearly took my life because I'd created a life that I didn't know how to rearrange. I wanted the real parts of me back. I wanted to do exactly what it is the Interfaith Alliance is doing and working toward every day. And as Donna got up and spoke, Donna Redwing got up and spoke so beautifully about supporting everyone and making sure that equality reigns and that we feel free to worship and be our gay selves, if that's what we are. I sure wish I would have known about the Interfaith Alliance, but I'm awfully glad that I do now, because I can continue to lend a hand when a hand was lent to me.
Country singer Shelley Wright received the President's Award. We brought you an interview with 2011 Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award recipient Right Reverend Bishop Jane Holmes Dixon several weeks ago on the show. Now, here are some highlights from her remarks at the award ceremony itself in New York City.
To have my name in the same sentence with Walter Cronkite is an honor indeed, something I never expected in my life. So, thank you. Actually, my work with Interfaith began with my children, because when they were young and were bringing friends home from school, they really brought into my life for the first time Jewish friends. I grew up in this country town where there were two Jewish families, of parents and their daughter and her husband. I knew a few Jewish girls when I went to college, but not many. But my children went to school, and their friends, they didn't know what religion they were or what they weren't. But they came into our homes day after day after day, and it began to open my eyes to being in relationship of people who might believe somewhat differently for me. Being in a world with people who believe differently. When I was rector of a small church out in Laurel, Maryland, during the time of Desert Storm, it became important to us in that community that we pray together. And so I'm going to brag on the Episcopal Church for a moment. You just have to put up with that. But the Episcopal Church and the people who worship there, the vestry, the governing board of that church, I went to them and I said, we need to have a prayer service where we have not only our Jewish sisters and brothers, but our Muslim sisters and brothers, our Baha'i sisters and brothers, our Hindu brothers and sisters, our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters, our Baptist brothers and sisters, all of us come together to pray that this desert storm will be ended. And so we did. And it was an important thing for me and continues to be that. Now I want to talk a minute about the work that I've been able to do for the dignity and respect of human beings, particularly women. At the center of my faith is a God who respects the dignity of every human being. And the words of the prophet Micah from the Hebrew Scriptures, when the prophet says, "And what does the Lord require but to do justice, to love mercy, to walk humbly with your God?" And so, when I went to seminary in the late 70s and early 80s, when you're in the Episcopal Seminary and you get ready to be ordained, they give you an examination. It's not as bad as the bar exam, but it's pretty tough, called the General Ordination Exam. And there's seven different areas that you have to be proficient in. They flunked me on ethics and moral theology. And I've always thought they flunked me because I had taken a positive stand on the ordination of gay and lesbian people. In fact, I appealed the decision. But the point is, I was ready to go to the standing committee who had to pass me for ordination and really give them a hard time. And one of the great mentors of my life, Dr. Verna Dozier, said to me, "You better behave yourself, because if you don't, you'll never be in a position to stand with your gay and lesbian brothers and sisters." How right she was, because some years later, when I was president of the standing committee of the Diocese of Washington, the first female priest, lesbian woman in a committed relationship, was to be ordained. And there was quite a discernment in the Episcopal Church. I can assure you people were worried about givers. Were they going to take back their money from the cathedral and this, that, and the other? And I was able to stand with the then Bishop of Washington, Ronald Haynes, who had the courage to ordain her. So all of these things have come together in my life. People who have been there when I needed them to show me the way. And the one, of course, who took me by the hand 51 years ago, David Dixon. When we were at Vanderbilt, he was a law student, and I was graduating from undergraduate school. And I've always said that Dixie has the Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other. And we stood on the perimeters of the civil rights movement. We had to move to Washington to get far enough away to really live into what we believed about our faith. And he is the one who stands by me. And when things get tough, he's always there. He doesn't like me to talk too long, so I have to hush. But I want to thank him tonight because he did, in fact, take me literally by the hand and say, this is the right thing to do. And you are given the opportunity to be a voice for those right now who don't have a voice. Someone has had a voice for you. So stand up and be brave. I love you. Thank you all. It's been wonderful.
Right Reverend Jane Holmes Dixon was the second woman to be consecrated bishop and has a long legacy of working both within and beyond the Episcopal Church, promoting respect and equality for members of racial minorities, women, and LGBT persons. She's been a pioneer in interfaith work in her ministry, and she's served on both the board and the staff of Interfaith Alliance. To hear my recent interview with Bishop Dixon, please visit stateofbelief.com. We need to take a quick break, but there's much more of this special Thanksgiving edition of State of Belief Radio still to come. You'll hear more highlights from the 2011 Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony, as well as some thoughts, great thoughts, on gratitude during difficult times from past Cronkite Award honoree Rabbi Irwin Kula. So please stay tuned. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Jim Lehrer, the legendary PBS news anchor, received the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award at this year's gala celebration in New York City. In his over 35 years as a PBS news anchor, Jim Lehrer has set the standard for unbiased, straightforward reporting and currently provides a much-needed model for quiet civility in the midst of loud rancor. Here is PBS news anchor Jim Lehrer.
You know the old saying that you're known by the company you keep? Well, I would like to be known forever. From this point on, just remember the company I kept here tonight. I'm talking about Jane. I'm talking about all of you. I'm talking about Shelley. I'm talking about all of you and the work that you do. And I'm talking, of course, to be given an award in the name of Walter Cronkite for somebody who has been doing what I do for as long as I've been doing it, to get an award in the name of Walter Cronkite, deserved or not, is about as good as it's ever going to get. And I thank you so much for that. Let me just say a couple of things about civil discourse. We've been doing it for 36 years on our television program, and the reason is because Robert McNeil, when we first started, he said, you know, we're going to be in the civil discourse business. And it's amazing that here we are 36 years later, And he's long retired, but our program is still in the civil discourse business, and I'm very, very proud of that. I recently cited, and I cite all the time, if anybody wants to know what civil discourse is and whether or not it's possible to have it on television, just watch on Friday nights David Brooks and Mark Shields. Those of you who watch the program, and I'm sure every one of you does, you know that Mark and David don't talk over each other. They don't shout at each other. They listen to each other. They're secure enough to even agree with each other occasionally. They are people, they do their homework. They do their reporting. They never attack anybody, and they never quote somebody anonymously in an attack mode. They are there to, McNeil used to say all the time, the easiest thing to do on television is to set a fire. The hardest thing to do on television is to shed light. And that is also what we do with Mark and David and with the program generally. Let me say one thing about the journalism, the kind of journalism that I practice and the kind of journalism I believe in. And I happen to believe that all serious journalists share this. Serious journalists have to be optimists. There is no way in the world you can be a pessimist and practice journalism on a regular basis. You have to believe that all the problems that you all mentioned here tonight and that are mentioned every night on the NewsHour, there's a way to solve that problem. And we're going to talk about it. If you didn't believe you could solve the problem, how in the world could you get your act together and do the work that was required to run a discussion about solving the problem of Social Security or hate or you fill in the blanks? And every serious journalist I know is an optimist. And I know I am. And I believe that, yes, things get rough at times. And this is a rough time. Oh, but rougher than what? It's always going to be a rough time. And the way you solve a rough time is by shedding some light on it and have a discussion about it that is civilized, and you pay attention and you listen and you listen and you listen, and eventually the problem will get solved. That's what I believe. A few years ago, I was asked, along with some others, to attend a seminar at Aspen about the future of American journalism. But one thing they asked each one of us, did we have any personal guidelines that we used for our own particular practice of journalism? And if we did, would you mind sharing them? Well, here's in part what I said. These are my personal guidelines for practicing journalism that have been inculcated in and are now part of what we do at the NewsHour. Do nothing I cannot defend. Cover, write, and present every story with the care I would want if the story were about me. Assume there is at least one other side or version to every story. Assume the viewer is as smart and as caring and as good a person as I am. Assume the same about all people on whom I report. Assume personal lives are a private matter until a legitimate turn in the story absolutely mandates otherwise. Carefully separate opinion and analysis from straight news stories and clearly label everything. Do not use anonymous sources or blind quotes except on rare and monumental occasions. No one should ever be allowed to attack another anonymously. And finally, I am not in the entertainment business. Thank you again for this award.
Some words from legendary PBS News anchor Jim Lara as he received the Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award given by Interfaith Alliance. Coming up after this break, more highlights from the 2011 Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Award ceremony in New York City. And later, thoughts on Thanksgiving from Rabbi Irwin Kula. This is State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. As part of Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony this year in New York 2 weeks ago, the recipients took part in a panel discussion. Here are some excerpts from the Right Reverend Dixon, Jim Lara, and Shelley Wright's remarks. Jim, I'm going to begin with you. How is the news business doing?
Did you all hear the question there in the back of the room? The question was, how many times have I been to New York City? Oh, Welton. The thing that troubles me the most is the line between the three legitimate forms of journalism, which is straight news reporting. Then that's one. Second is analysis. In other words, what happened? All right, analysis, what does it mean? And number three, what is my opinion or what is somebody else's opinion? What should your opinion be? That's opinion journalism. It's also, these are all very legitimate things. But they should be done by three separate people. And the lines between those three categories are disappearing in a way that I think is not good.
You've just you've done this new book on presidential debates, right, which is so good. How do you feel about the way the presidential debates now are unfolding in the Republican primaries, and what would be your counsel as we move into the election
year? Look, you got to remember there are two sets of debates here. The primary debates are designed to weed the field. And when the Democratic debates first began in 2008, the worst debater on the stage was Barack Obama. But by the second debate, Obama got a little bit better. And the third debate, he got even better and better and better and better, et cetera. I have two major problems with them, is having audiences. They turned into pep rallies and all of that. I think that hurts the whole process. The national debates are entirely different category. The ones that I moderated, they're at the end of the campaign. By the time these debates come, over 90% of the people already decided for whom they're going to vote or are leaning. So the purpose of those debates is take the measure of the individual. Can you imagine this person sitting behind a desk in the Oval Office making a decision about sending Americans into harm's way or reacting to another Katrina or reacting to another 9/11? Presidencies are about the unexpected. Campaigns are about the expected.
Jane, given your incredible vision of interfaith understanding and mutual understanding and cooperation, do you feel positive or negative about where we are in that regard?
I loved what Jim said about you have to be an optimist. Despair is never the response of the faithful Christian person. So speaking as a Christian person, I see great strides in interfaith work. The fact is, more and more people are standing in pulpits, on bemas, and where people come together. I am optimistic about it. I'm not despairing. I am convinced that people are beginning to understand, because like my children, children are going to school with people who have different belief systems. I'm sure it's more true in Washington, D.C. than it is in Winona, Mississippi. I'm not foolish enough not to think that. But it's very hard these days not to have interaction with people who come from a different religious tradition.
Right.
Yeah. And so that's my great hope.
Shelley, I think the question that I get asked most about you. When it was bad, what kept you going?
When it was bad, what kept me going was love for lots of things in my life, music and friends and family, and I think a pure love of myself, which came from a spiritual knowing. A lot of young LGBT folks tend to walk away from their faith, and I liken that to a playground experience. You all remember being in third grade. You remember going outside and being chosen for the kickball team, and they line kids up and they choose that kid and that kid and that kid and that kid. And then somehow there's one kid that never gets chosen, and he never gets to play. And I liken that to the experience of a young LGBT person, in that you go to your church service or your house of worship repeatedly and you're told, well, you'll never get to play. You'll never get to fit in. You're not one of us. You'll never get to play kickball. You'll never get to worship the Lord in quite the fashion that we get to do, because God likes us better. And I see a lot of young folks eventually feel like they have to choose these parts of themselves, and they walk away from their faith practice. And I fortunately did not. And that is simply by the grace of God. And I had that deep understanding early on that God was good with me. And so I think that was what kept me going, although there was a fatigue in that. And when the fatigue finally metabolized itself deep within me, when I was done, I was done. And my love for music and family and sunshine and puppies and writing songs and love for myself just became something that wasn't fuel enough for me anymore. And that's when true surrender happened. And I couldn't believe how good that true surrender felt.
I'm interested about how does the media treat religion. Jim, you feel satisfied with that? Are there special challenges that aren't being met? How is that going?
I hate to talk about the old days. In the old days, it used to be every newspaper, even the ones I worked for in Texas, had religion editors.
Right.
And they were reported on like you'd have an agriculture editor or a labor editor or
right.
a political editor. It's no longer the case. Some people would argue that's a good thing, because religion is now such an integral part of everything, including politics, that it's there. You don't have to cover it as a special kind of thing. What has gotten lost, I think, is that mainstream media has probably fallen down, and it's just explaining what people believe and why they believe it. The unknown is always a little bit off-putting, and I think as a matter of journalism, we need to do a better job in doing that. And, of course, religion is now, there's so many people killing each other in the names of religion, various religions, and defending themselves in the names of religion. It can't escape. It's always in the news. But what is missing are those second and third, fourth, I would call backstory stories that are not being told.
Yeah. What do you all feel?
Well, to just follow what Jim said, I think that it's very hard to give a theological explanation to something in a soundbite. And to talk about what the Bible says about homosexuality. I mean, you've got to start in Genesis, then you've got to go to Leviticus, then you've got to say what Paul said in Romans. And by the time you get through all of that to what Jesus says, what God says about loving every human being, you're lost. People are back in the holiness code in Leviticus about thou shalt not. And so that for me has been one of the real challenges when people have asked me from the media to say, to talk about something that I believe in, why I stand for what I stand for, how can I come to that from a biblical or a scriptural basis. It's just very difficult to do that in, say, two sentences.
Shelley, I'm going to change it just a little. What about country music and religion?
Yeah, country music and religion have a long and very close-knit relationship. But as you said earlier, they do have quite a margin for beer drinking, rebel rousing, as my Aunt Char would say. There are margins for certain behaviors that you would never talk about in a house of worship. So they're a bit of there's a paradox happening within the community of country music. But there seems to be an understanding of, a misunderstanding, however, that you can't be a person of faith and be gay, and certainly you can't be on the Grand Ole Opry stage and be a person like me. And as the great Peter Gomes said, that in the 60s, when he came out as a man of faith, a leader in the faith community, and a gay man, he said, when people would implore me, "You cannot be that. You cannot be a gay Christian. They don't go together." And the journalist said, "Well, what did you say, Mr. Gomes? How did you respond?" And he said, "I said, I offer my life as evidence to the contrary." And that's kind of, that's what my coming out has served to do. I was uniquely positioned in my community of country music, and if they think that they hadn't bought the record of a gay person and stood in line for my autograph, well, I offer my life as evidence to the contrary.
You can hear more from this year's Interfaith Alliance Walter Cronkite Faith and Freedom Awards ceremony in New York City on our website, stateofbelief.com. Congratulations to our awardees, and great thanks to the attendees, donors, and supporters who made the celebration and the essential work of Interfaith Alliance possible. You can learn more about that work and see photographs and video from this year's Faith and Freedom Awards at www.interfaithalliance.org. We've got to take a short break, but coming right up, we'll get some thoughts on gratitude during difficult times from Rabbi Irwin Kula. No stranger to this show, always a man with a great message, when our special Thanksgiving program continues in just a minute. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio, everyone. I'm Welton Gaddy. We started the year 2011 with Rabbi Irwin Kula on our New Year's Day show, sharing some profound thoughts on creating positive change every day. In his words, lighting one candle. If you've forgotten the wisdom Rabbi Kula shared with us that day, I encourage you to listen again by visiting the archive section of our website, stateofbelief.com. As Americans pause now to observe Thanksgiving, I am delighted to welcome Rabbi Kula back to State of Belief to share some thoughts about being grateful. Being grateful in an especially difficult time. Irwin, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
I want your help in encouraging folks to first stop, calm down, and really think about giving thanks no matter what their circumstances.
You know, the opposite of gratitude is feeling entitled. I know I look at my life and I look at my kids relative to my parents who... My father passed away just 6 weeks ago, and I look and I say, you know, I actually feel a lot more entitled than my father ever did, yet alone his father, right, who grew up in Europe and lived through pogroms. And I think that part of what we have to begin to do, all of us, all up and down the food chain, from the people who have the least to the people who have the most, is to take a big step back and say, what really is important in our lives that we're grateful for, that actually we're not entitled to? No one's entitled automatically to life. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest gift of all. If we get up in the morning and we take a breath, we already have something to thank for. No one's entitled to love. Love is an incredible gift. If we have a spouse or a partner, or we have a friend, or we have a brother or a sister, or a neighbor who we are in a relationship with, and there's a sense of obligation and commitment and care and concern, we're not entitled to that. That's a tremendous gift. Whether you're religious and you call it a gift from God, or whether you are not, you're secular and you say the universe is unfolded this way. And what we have to do is begin to look at the things that we really are, the bottom line stuff that we're grateful for.
Erwin, talk about your message that gratitude is a choice, not just as a feeling.
We've replaced actions with feelings. Now, feelings are very important, but feelings independent of action, and just depending on spontaneous eruption of feelings, is not actually building a life. And I think gratitude, when we think of something like gratitude, I always say, is two things. One, it's a choice, and two, it's practice. So one, you have to choose to be grateful. I have hundreds of things happening in my day, and I have to make a choice which ones I'm going to emphasize and allow to dominate my awareness and consciousness, and which ones I'm not. We now know from neuroscience that, and positive psychology, but we knew this from religion a long time ago, that the baseline for us, which is basically that life is okay, we're alive and we're making it through it day by day, the baseline we take for granted. And what gets our attention is when something is off. We have to reverse that. And we actually have to be attentive to the baseline. And then when things are off, we'll deal with them. And that we have to practice. And the only way to practice it is to give attention to the normal, ordinary stuff that usually we take for granted.
You're not denying the negative realities. You are making a choice to focus on the gifts that evoke thanksgiving, right?
It turns out that this is the least delusional way to live, because it's not Pollyannish. It's not saying there isn't real significant hardship, but the fact is that the best possibility I have of bringing all of who I am, all my talents, all my capacities, all my intelligence, all my energy to dealing with the genuine hardships I have, the best shot I have is by being in a position of being grateful for what I do have. We also know that part of the practice of gratitude, and every tradition has this, that everyone has the capability of helping someone who's more vulnerable than them.
One other point that I've heard you make is we need to become grateful for the partial. We don't have to have the whole in order to give thanks.
Yeah, there's a great practice that we Jews have on Passover. It's called Dayenu, in which we say it would have been enough. It would have been enough if the only thing that happened is we went out of Egypt but didn't cross the sea. It would have been enough. It would have been enough if we crossed the sea, but if we didn't get through the desert. If we can divide up our life with a greater attention, we can begin to be grateful for the partial. And what I say, we should always want it all and always be finding enough. And holding those two things together is really the wisdom of gratitude. So the day ends, I say, gosh, you know, that if the only thing that happened to me was I woke up in the morning, but you know what? The deal didn't come through. Dayenu, it would have been enough. If the only thing that happened to me was I got to see my kids who are healthy and they're going to school but you know, it didn't work out with my job today. It would have been enough. If the only thing that happens to me is that I was able to make a call to my parents who I was able to say I love you, with all the complexity of my relationship with my parents, it would have been enough. If the only thing that I could do, if the only thing I had today was this Thanksgiving meal with my family and friends, even though my uncle is a hassle, and even though I'm not talking to my brother 100%, and it's complicated, if this was the only thing I had, it would have been enough.
Rabbi Erwin Kula has appeared on Newsweek magazine's list of America's most influential rabbis, the author of Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life. Rabbi Kula is the president of CLOW, the National Jewish Center for Learning and Leadership. Erwin, I'm grateful for who you are and for the way in which you help a lot of us enjoy special days in ways that carry over in very common moments. So thank you for being on State of Belief Radio again, and happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, and I'm grateful for you for actually making religion really alive and moral and ethical in this country.
Dianu.
Dianu. That's beautiful.
That's all the time we have for this week's show, believe it or not. I hope you'll join us next week when we'll be broadcasting from Des Moines, Iowa, as that state prepares for the first step in the 2012 Republican presidential nominating process, the Iowa caucus, on January 3rd. We're going to be right in the middle of it. In the meantime, please visit us online at stateofbelief.com to find out more about the show, to hear extended interviews, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. Share your thoughts on what you've heard on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available at stateofbelief.com, including the listener line 202-238-3291. While you're talking about all of the issues we talk about on State of Belief Radio, remember it's a production of Interfaith Alliance. You can become a member today of Interfaith Alliance at interfaithalliance.org. We'd love to have you in the membership. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.